It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It was a year ago today that a gunman walked into a Sikh temple near Milwaukee and opened fire. It came out that he was motivated in part by a neo-Nazi ideology.
This weekend, members of the Oak Creek community marked the anniversary. Chuck Quirnbach has this report.
At the Sikh temple in the Milwaukee suburb of Oak Creek, there's very little physical sign of the damage gunman Wade Michael Page caused on August 5th, 2012, when he killed six people before being shot by police and then killing himself. Temple official Dr. Harcharan Gill says the main exception is a small round hole on an inner door frame.
This is one of the bullet holes. It's indicating that it's always going to remind us what happened on the 5th.
The temple has installed more security cameras, and a security guard is often on duty. But the anniversary events over the last few days have stressed openness and a much brighter theme, namely a Sikh term, Chardi Kala, which roughly translates to relentless optimism. At a memorial service yesterday at the temple, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker praised the Sikhs for not calling for revenge, but for greater community understanding and peace.
The brightest moment out of all this is that, yet again, you've showed this community, this state, this country, and the world that love can triumph.
The Sikhs have taken their positive response to the federal courthouse in downtown Milwaukee. Traditional Sikh music was performed in the courthouse's ceremonial courtroom on Friday, prior to a memorial service there. U.S. Attorney James Santel read a letter from Attorney General Eric Holder, which declared that the Justice Department will now keep track of hate crimes against the Sikhs and six other religious or ethnic groups. Santel, who sometimes now attends religious services at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, also declared the courthouse to be a temple, or the Sikh term, Gurdwara.
That by gathering here, in this temple, in this place, in this Gurdwara of justice, that our six sisters and brothers are one with us, of us, and always among us.
Amardeep Kalika, whose father was one of the people killed in the Oak Creek shootings, says the prosecutor was right to refer to the federal courthouse as a Gurdwara.
In our culture, anything can be a Gurdwara. So you can have a closet in your house, it's a Gurdwara. But in addition, a courthouse, that's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Gurdwaras are symbols of justice.
The Sikhs also took their outreach to the streets of Oak Creek on Saturday with a 6-kilometer run and walk to raise money for a community scholarship fund. Hundreds of runners and walkers stepped off to the sound of a traditional Sikh drum and cry.
Bole!
The event drew both Sikhs and non-Sikhs. Temple trustee Ben Singh Voparai says he took part to promote unity and improve the world.
So if everybody act together, practice peace, and this planet can be a heaven. So we are trying to make it the better place for everybody to live.
Milwaukee area police and FBI chaplain Greg Young, who provided crisis counseling after last year's Oak Creek shooting, says he ran partly for inner peace.
I train a lot of law enforcement around the country, and one of the things I always talk about in terms of resilience is how do you take care of yourself, how do you play? And so we need ways that we can unplug, that we can celebrate.
Other Milwaukee Sikh leaders are expanding an effort in the schools to reduce violence. That may be a tall order. On a weekend when Sikhs and others gathered to remember six worshippers killed a year ago, police say at least two Milwaukee residents died in street violence, and about a dozen local people were wounded.
That was Chuck Quirnbach from our Milwaukee Bureau. And now Chuck joins us to talk about a candlelight vigil scheduled for tonight at the Sikh temple. Chuck, we've heard reports that speakers at tonight's event will focus on reducing gun violence. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, that's right. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is among the scheduled speakers. He's been quite outspoken about the need for greater restrictions on guns. You know, off and on, the Sikhs themselves have talked about reducing gun violence. It hasn't been a major theme because it's a pretty controversial topic. And they've tried to keep the focus on remembering the victims and building community understanding about the Sikhs. I spoke recently with Pradeep Kalika. He's one of the sons of the temple leader killed last year. Pradeep says he's of two minds about even chatting about additional restrictions on guns.
Guns need to be discussed, and we need to have responsible ownership of guns. I don't want that to take the place of the... Sometimes when you get into the gun discussion, you have a lot of ears close up.
Hmm. I was going to say, another person active at the Sikh temple, Mandeep Kaur, is a little more forceful. She says there have to be more background checks for gun buyers.
Should we not allow people to own guns? I think it's a right. You know, it's a way for them to feel safe. But you need to be able to be responsible at the same time.
And we have one more person I spoke to recently, temple activist Raul Dubé, is also on the board of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, or WAVE, one of the larger anti-gun groups in the state. Dubé even mentions the name of last year's temple shooter, Wade Michael Page.
Person like Wade Page, I'm not going to say he was mentally sick, but because I haven't gotten into the medical history, but he had problems of alcoholic issues. So that's what we need, actually. Background checks is a must.
Well, Chuck, throughout your conversations with the Sikh community over the past week, what other kinds of concerns have you heard?
Well, you know, there's, as I say, this need, desire for greater understanding for the community. Certainly, I think the community police leaders in Oak Creek and mayor and police leaders in the region, the U.S. Attorney's Office, have all connected well with the Sikh community, and they get it. I think there's a greater desire now to connect with more people throughout the community, and also have a greater effort to try and reduce some of the violence in the broader community, which affects people, seems to, every day pretty much in Milwaukee.
Mm. You reported that the Justice Department will keep track of hate crimes against Sikhs now. How are they doing that? And is it part of a greater effort to track hate crimes?
Well, that's right. There's six other groups the Justice Department and FBI will keep track of as well. You know, there's a database.
And we've lost Chuck Quirnbach, but we thank Chuck for filing that report and sharing some of those conversations with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up next, we'll check the headlines and then hear from a reporter in Mexico City about the effects the global fishing industry is having on our oceans. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. In the mid-20th century, international efforts to increase the availability of protein-rich foods led to a government campaign to increase fishing capacity.
But by about 10 years ago, it was estimated that industrial fishing had reduced the number of large ocean fish to just 10% of their pre-industrial population.
And in 2006, a study in the journal Science predicted that if fishing rates continue as is, all the world's fisheries will have collapsed by the year 2048.
Our guest now took a look at overfishing in one particular spot and some lessons we can learn from there. He recently wrote an article in Harper's titled Employing the World's Aquarium. Eric Vance is a science writer. He joins us from Mexico City. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
You did your research in the Sea of Cortez in the Gulf of California. What is the aquatic life there now?
Oh, that's good. First, I should say it's the title is actually Emptying the World's Aquarium. It's really hard to actually sum up the aquatic life in the Sea of Cortez because it's unusually varied. The temperatures change a lot. The depth changed a lot. How clear the water changes a lot. It's a very multifaceted place, and as a result, there's an incredible variety of life. So that's actually one of the reasons I focused on it, is because there was this huge variety, and there's this long history of fishing and of people going to the Sea of Cortez and counting the living things there in the oceans. That I thought it was an interesting place to sort of look at the world's at the world's oceans from sort of a lens, but it's incredibly variable. You can probably find if you looked at any other space the same size, you wouldn't see that kind of variety.
And hence the world's aquarium, because there was so much natural variety there.
Yeah. Jacques Cousteau called it the world's aquarium, and it's partly because of the clarity, and partly because he felt like whenever he got in the water, you were going to an aquarium. Everything just sort of was there for you to look at, and it was startling to him.
It was also obviously interesting to commercial fishing. How did it get started, and how did it take off there?
Well, that's a good question. The Sea of Cortez has the fortune or the misfortune of being right next to the United States, and also within shooting distance of traditionally very large markets in Japan and Korea, which were very active in the sea even back in the 40s when John Steinbeck visited. They've always been in a good place to provide the very big markets, which is probably a good part of the reason why they're no longer the seas that they once were. They got started sort of slowly, providing really high class fish, tuna and some very expensive fish to those markets. But then they started working what they call working their way down the food chain, selling other kinds of seafood, crabs, and now pretty much whatever they can sell, all the way down to jellyfish. Actually, jellyfish get shipped to China, which is the new large market out there, and they will actually buy this floppy jellyfish from the Sea of Cortez for a very, very low cost.
And you said working their way down the food chain, and what happens? They fish for the favored fish. How long does it take till it starts running low?
That's a good point. It depends on the fish. In the Sea of Cortez, there's this really interesting trend where, these fish will come into favor. So take the, not a fish, but the reptile, a sea turtle that were just really popular back in the 60s. And it took about 10 years and the populations just crashed. And then there were some other fish. And in the 90s, another very distinct example was the sharks that were very popular for Chinese shark fin soup that's eaten at weddings and other times of special times of the year. And there was, again, a huge crash. Both of those animals are very slow growing, and their populations don't bounce back. So turtles aren't exactly the top of the food chain, but sharks certainly are, dolphins certainly are. And those animals take, they take a long time to reproduce. And then the further down the food chain you get, the more, the cheaper the animals tend to be, and the quicker they can respond.
You open the story talking about kind of a wildcat fisherman, somebody who's doing this on his own. And as the fish get harder and harder to find, they take bigger risks to get the fish. Can you tell his story?
Sure. In this particular area, it's called Kino, and it's really well known for fishermen who scuba dive. And for those listeners who have scuba dived before, they probably imagine a tank on your back as you swim along. Well, it's the same idea, except that his tank is in the boat, and he has a long tube coming down to where he's diving, and he's breathing through the tube. But it's still compressed air, and so the effect is still the same, that if you stay underwater too long, too deeply, you can get the bends, which is when basically your body, the lack of a better word, turns into sort of a Coke can that gets shooken up, and if you come up too fast, the bubbles can form all throughout your body and wreck, horrible damage to your body. And so this gentleman was down at 120 feet for 2.5 hours, which is, if you're going to go down that deep, 20 minutes is the longest you should stay down, and then take a long time coming back up. But he was down there for 2.5 hours because he felt like if he waited or if he took his time, he'd come back the next week and there wouldn't be any, in this case, shellfish that he was fishing for. And he was pulling them up by hand, one at a time. It's a very tricky technique. You have to walk along and feel for these things that are barely peeking out of the sand, and then you hook them and you pull them out of the sand. It's really, very tricky. And he just felt like there was a new bed. These shellfish had been discovered at these really low depths. And he said that he thought they weren't going to be there very long, so he just took the risk. And after 2.5 hours, he started to get a little drunk. And this is something called nitrogen narcosis, where your body gets basically the same as being inebriated. And he got nervous, so he started going back up the rope to the boat, and he lost a hold of the rope, he said, because of a current. And it swept him up to the surface, and so basically he went from 120 feet to the surface very quickly, and that's just insanely dangerous, and he paid the price, and he'll probably never walk again.
And that was an example of how people are having to do, whether it's taking risks or more and more extreme practices, as the fish or shellfish or turtles they rely on get harder and harder to find. They have to work harder and harder to get them.
Yeah, and it's not just people diving deeper. I mean, he was diving deeper. Other people are going further out to sea. Right now, my photographer and I, in that story, we're looking talking to some other folks who are going further and further out into the sea and risking higher seas in these tiny little 15-foot, 20-foot pangas, looking for the fish that used to be right next to shore. And these are people who don't have a lot of other options. Their children might. Some of these fishermen are sending their children inland to be, you know, to do other work. But if you've been doing this for 40 years, this is what you do. And you just take the longer risk. You put out more nets. That's the thing about this is people won't say right off, oh, there's no more fish. We don't see any more fish. They'll say, oh, we have the same amount of fish. And you have to ask them, well, how far do you go? Well, we go about three times as far as we used to. How many nets do you put out? We put out about five times as much net as we used to. And we get the same amount of fish. So it's kind of insidious in that way, and that a lot of people don't want to see what's happening, because this is what they've done, perhaps for generations.
And then there's the other kind of fishing you write about, fishing in trawlers. How does that work?
Well, a trawler is, it's essentially a big fishing boat, the way that most Americans will think of a fishing boat. And it has usually two large sort of scoop-like nets that drag behind it. And if it's the open water, they sort of drag through the open water. But if it's even a little bit shallow, they drag along the bottom of the ocean floor, sort of pulling up whatever happens to be there, whether it's, you know, corals or sponges or fish or whatever it is. And they may trawl for 3, 4, 6 hours. And then once they feel like there's enough material in the net, they'll pull them up. So the effect to the ocean floor is a little like a steamroller as these things crisscross over the Sea of Cortez. And I've even read as much as in some places the same spot will see, you know, as many as four times a year, the trawler will go over the same spot, just continuing to sort of re-hit the places it's already hit, trying to squeeze out those last fish.
And the trawlers blame the other fishermen. The fishermen blame the trawlers. Is it a net impact of, sorry, no pun intended with net, but is it an overall impact of all the kinds of fishing there?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot of this back and forth that when I went down there, you talk to a lot of people who say, well, if we just get rid of the trawlers, it's these big business, you know, people who are ruining everything. And then the trawlers will say, well, it's you know, the thousands of pangas that are on the water. It's something like 25,000 pangas that are on the water in the Sea of Cortez. And it's just the sheer volume. They may not take in as much volume as we do, but it's just there's so many of them. And it's hard to parse. The sad thing in all of this is that whether you're in a panga or in a trawler, the real problem is that we're not eating our way through the fish of the ocean. We're actually throwing them overboard in order to get the stuff we want to eat. So, you know, on a bad day, you know, maybe 10% of what we catch, either in a trawler, in a smaller boat, these numbers aren't as solid, but certainly in a trawler, 10% is what we want, and the rest is just thrown overboard. Now, if you're a fish and you've been bumping around in a net for 4 hours as it trawls along the bottom, you're probably dead by the time you come up. And those fish get thrown overboard. And so it's really the waste, I think, that really got me with this story, is just how much we're not using because we want those few shrimp or halibut or whatever it is that we are aiming for. The tragedy is what we're throwing away to get them.
Talking to Eric Vance. He's a science writer based in Mexico City. His new piece on overfishing is in Harper's. It's called Emptying the World's Aquarium. Coming up, we're going to talk about what people are trying to do to protect some of the fish involved, whether farmed fish are part of the solution or maybe another part of the problem. That's coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time. Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. We continue our conversation now with Eric Vance, a science writer based in Mexico City. His piece is called Emptying the World's Aquarium. We have a link to that. It's in Harper's Magazine. We've talked a little bit about overfishing. It's a worldwide problem. Eric's piece focuses on the Sea of Cortez and the diminishing returns fishermen, the fishing industry sees. They fish for one type, it runs out, they go for another type of fish or shellfish. Eric, I want to turn to the impact on wildlife populations now. How many endangered species are we seeing as a result of all this?
It's really hard to know the answer to that question. There's no question, but for two reasons. There's no question this is impacting the population of many species. The problem is you know, what constitutes an endangered species, and for many animals this is hard to know. Like for sharks, sharks is the one that I think is really interesting because it's happening now, and the problem is we don't know how many there were originally. With many of the bigger, cooler, sort of more interesting sharks that we all know, the hammerheads, the great whites, we don't have good numbers for what was there originally. So we can't know how many we've lost. Oftentimes numbers like we've lost, you know, we're 90%, we've lost 90% of our, of one species. We've lost, you know, 80%. These are very common. A population is considered collapsed when it hits 10%. Of its historic number, so a lot of these populations have collapsed. But it's hard to know for sure how many. The famous ones, the sharks, are really struggling. The Totoaba is the one that is—it's this sort of drum that was very popular 50 years ago, and as a result of that, and it only lives in the Sea of Cortez, and as a result of that, it's disappeared. But it's still being hunted today, and shipped overseas to Asia. And then the other one that's very well known is actually the vaquita, which is the world's most endangered marine mammal. It's a sort of a small porpoise, and there's only a couple hundred left. And they are actually not eaten. They're caught up in the nets with everything else, and then die as a result of that.
Well, even as these populations of fish go down, there's still the demand from the United States, from Japan, everywhere else you mentioned earlier, and some places where you're working are turning to farm-based fishing. Is that a part of the solution, or are we seeing problems with that too?
That's a good question. It's often the panacea that's offered up, and you're absolutely right. You know, it's an interesting statistic I often think about, which is, you know, we've, you know, I said, you know, 90% less, you know, all these fish populations seem to be shrinking, yet the demand for fish has doubled since the 1980s, and the prices, while they may feel expensive, have actually stayed mostly flat, going up with inflation. What kind of product can you cut down the supply, increase, double the demand, and the prices stay the same? And the answer is we just catch a lot more of it now. And so it's completely unsustainable. So there is this question of, well, can we farm them? Is there any way that we can increase, you know, just get the shrimp and not get all the bycatch? And it's a great idea. We're not there yet. There's some pollution problems, and the biggest problem in my mind, and all I really care about, is I want my kids to have fish to see when they go swimming in the ocean. And my kids aren't born yet, so that's a ways in the future. So the thing that I worry about is, what are we feeding the fish that are in the farms. Well, we feed them ground-up fish from the ocean. And in some cases, four times as much fish gets ground up and fed to, say, the salmon or the shrimp than what we take out. So that, again, is not sustainable. It doesn't matter if we're catching it in our nets or if we're grinding it up to use as food, if we're using more than we're taking out, or if there's not a balance between what we're taking out and what we're leaving behind.
Well, around the world, international organizations, national governments, and the fishing industry, fisher people, are trying to figure out what to do about this. What kind of things did you see in the Sea of Cortez, efforts to preserve these species?
Well, it's tough. And the great thing about the story, you have to read the story to get a lot of the details. The great thing is that they're trying a lot of the things that people are trying around the world are popping up in the Sea of Cortez. So one of them was, well, we'll create a marine park. No fishing in this place because there's something special here. And that works sometimes. And there's one place in the south called Cabo Pulmo where populations have bounced back 400% in a very small place. And then up north, there's a massive park to protect the Baquita, and it's also seen some success, but the people who live there hate it, really hate it. And they've acted out somewhat violently, and you can't do conservation without the people who live there being involved. We know that now. We've learned that after many years of doing it wrong. Everyone who lives there has to be at least somewhat involved. And so I don't know if I'd call that a success, but there's some other interesting techniques or ideas that are popping up. And one of them I detail in my story, a guy by the name of Hoyt Peckham has this nonprofit, I think it's a nonprofit, called Bromar, and he's basically saying, well, these fishermen are, the problem isn't that they need to catch more fish, they need to make enough money to feed their families and provide for their future. So what if we get them more money, cut out the middleman, and allow them to get paid better for the same fish that they're already catching? It's a really interesting idea. It's there's a fish called cabrilla, which the fishermen there they toss on the beach. It smells horrible. It goes rotten. You sort of mix in some lemon, and then you sell it really cheaply. Well, what if you don't do that? What if you preserve that fish, put it on ice, clean it, bring it back to the city? You can sell it for, rather than cents per the pound, you can sell it for, dollars to the pound, and that can go straight to the fishermen. So that it's the same fish, but they don't have to catch as many of them if they're making more money. And you can also use that money to help police the fish and make sure that they're fishing responsibly, and if they're making the same or more, then they're happy. It's a matter of making money to provide for their families, not we have to get this fish. So there's really creative ideas that are in the mix. The question is, will they be in time?
And then let's flip it around and look at the consumer end. You can go out there and find fairly baffling lists of what kind of fish we should and shouldn't buy. And it's hard, even if you're thinking about this stuff, it's hard to make decisions. What do we consumers have a role in protecting the Sea of Cortez?
Oh, goodness. Yes, we do. And I my heart goes out to you. My heart goes out to me. I have to do this, too. When I go out with my friends, and I actually blogged about this for a website called The Last Word on Nothing, and I try to give a list of what the best fish, how to best think about this. So, okay, you can't be a fish expert. You can't go into the restaurant. I do this, and I ask where the Chilean sea bass was caught. Nobody likes that. I mean, no, even my friends don't like it. So the one thing you can do, though, is you can tell your waiter, and most fish in the U.S. that we eat is eaten in restaurants. This is not like beef, which is mostly eaten at home. We eat fish in restaurants. So when you go to a restaurant, tell the waiter, I'm going to eat your halibut. I'll trust that it's, I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I want you to tell the chef, tell your manager, this is important to me. Even knowing that, and I've done other stories about this issue, and I've talked to chefs, and they say, well, if I thought anyone cared about where the fish was caught or how it was caught, I'd look into it, but I'm just too busy and I don't think anyone cares. If you just do that, just tell your chef, this is important to me, and next time I come in, I want to know where this halibut came from. That alone could make a huge difference. This industry is very sensitive to changes, and if people say they want sustainable fish, the industry will jump because it's very competitive.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was science writer Eric Vance. His piece, Emptying the World's Aquarium, is in Harper's. And we have a link to a short documentary he collaborated on. You can find that on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Coming up in a little bit, the author of So Good They Can't Ignore You. Have you heard the advice, follow your passion to find a career? Wrong, he says. We'll find out why coming up in a bit.
First, some writing advice we can use in our jobs, posting online, and in our daily lives.
Our guest is a writing guru with the Poynter Institute. He says we can say more by saying less.
Roy Peter Clark joins us. His new book is How to Write Short, Word Craft for Fast Times. Roy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for your hospitality. Glad to be here.
Well, tell us, why is it important to write short, especially today?
Not just today, but over all time. You know, this book looks back on the history of writing, from biblical proverbs to, up to Twitter, and suggests that we've always reserved our most important messages for the shortest sentences. You know, will you marry me? I do. Not guilty. The Giants win the pennant. You're fired. I love you. To be or not to be. These are things that we remember, and we remember them because they're short.
Hmm. Why is it harder to write short than it is to write long? I would say that the tendency often is to be verbose, like that question I just asked you.
The French scholar Blaise Pascal apologized to a correspondent and said, I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. And so there is this notion that, you know, once we get going, once we overcome some writer's block, we can't stop. But we have a lot of reasons to write shorter, including the use of various forms of writing in the digital age, Twitter, Facebook, text messaging. There's a lot of focus on how we can be more effective with fewer words.
And I've heard a lot of criticism, actually, about Twitter as actually being one of the means of degrading our language. What do you say to that?
Every technological advance has been followed by predictions of language degradation, and it's never true. Language is always changing, and the way language is used on various media platforms will just give the writer opportunities to write in new ways for new audiences. I think the most significant virtue that a writer can have in this day and age is versatility. The ability to write short, the ability to write long, the ability to write quick reports, the ability to write interesting and compelling stories. And my book offers lots of advice on how to be a truly versatile writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would imagine that to be a great writer and to have high impact when you write out those shorter sentences, that you would almost need to have a wider vocabulary so that you know exactly what word you wish to convey to get your meaning across. Is that true?
Well, I like to think that, you know, when I read the best writers on Twitter, it's usually not an unusual word or a different word, but it's like what I would call sort of in musical terms a sort of a grace note, a word that stands out as being interesting, distinctive, and reflecting the voice of the writer. So you don't have to be a fancier writer. You don't have to be a plain writer. You can be the kind of writer who writes with an original and authentic voice. And I think that's what we're all striving for.
Mm. How do we find that authentic voice?
Well, we find it by, there's really only three ways to become a more literate person. One is to read. The second is to write. in different forms. And the third is to talk about reading and writing and how meaning is made the way we're doing now. So that's the kind of thing that we need to practice in our schools. It's the thing that professionals practice every day in newsrooms and other and publishing houses. And there's no reason why we can't turn America into a nation of writers. That's always been my primary mission and purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to Twitter, I wanted to mention Scott Simon recently had used Twitter as a platform to communicate what he was going through as his mother was passing away. Did you follow him?
Yes, I followed him. And, you know, I had a chance to meet Scott. It's funny you should mention his name. Scott sort of inspired this book. I met him at the Tucson Festival of Books about 3 years ago, and he gave a little, taught a little lesson that he was taught by his stepfather. He said, I can almost quote him directly. He said, you know, we say that a picture is worth 1,000 words, but look at these famous historical documents. Let's look at the Hippocratic Oath, the 23rd Psalm, the Lord's Prayer, any Shakespeare sonnet, the preamble to the Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, the last paragraph of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. And he said, if you add all of the words in those famous and influential texts together, they come to fewer than 1,000. And I couldn't believe it. I went home, and that's the first thing I did, and I called him up. And ever since then, I said, you know, people have been saying the most important messages in the fewest number of words since the beginning of written history, and I need to write about this. So I want to thank Scott for his inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's unfortunate timing that he lost his mother at this time, but I was thinking about that because some of his tweets in just 140 characters or less were so powerful.
Yeah, I think I remember also a couple of years ago, at a time when I was sort of puzzled about Twitter, and I remember going on Twitter, and a young reporter for the Toronto Star named Joanna Smith had been sent to Haiti to cover the earthquake for her newspaper, and she filed these amazing dispatches by the minute, and I have one of them here. It says, fugitive from prison, caught looting, taken from police, beaten, dragged through street, died slowly and set on fire in a pile of garbage. And there was one amazing, interesting, gruesome, hopeful scene after the other. And I said, this is like a serial narrative in which each of the chapters is 140 characters long. Scott and Joanna and other writers are proving that you don't have to sort of search 140 characters, you know, in search of an author. These authors are there. They're using these writing strategies for the benefit of all audiences.
Well, take us, I guess, into their minds and give us a few tips. You know, how do we convey details and the richness of reality in just a few short words?
Well, my lesson, if I can play the... Do I have your permission to play the English teacher for just a second?
Sure.
Okay. So my daughter Allison was in Georgia Shakespeare version of Macbeth. And as I went to see her play, just at the end of the play, just before Macbeth is going to be killed and beheaded in battle, comes the announcement from a messenger who says to Macbeth, "The queen, my lord, is dead." And that sentence just reverberated in my head for... months. I got home, I reread the play, and I realized that Shakespeare didn't have to write it that way. He could have taken those six words, and he could have said, "The queen is dead, my lord," or "My lord, the queen is dead." But instead, he ordered them so that the most interesting and important and emphatic word came at the very end, right before the sentence, or what the Brits call the full stop. So that's probably the most significant writing strategy available to us. Place the most interesting and emphatic, important word at the end. It's that final punch. It's that thing that sears in our memory. And it's true in poetry, it's true in all of humor, in which the we all know that we laugh when we hear that last word or phrase, and it turns out to be true in digital forms of writing as well.
That is an interesting and valuable tip. Thank you. Well, you recommend also keeping a daybook devoted to short writing. Can you talk about how to get started on that?
Well, I learned this from a great writing teacher from New Hampshire named Donald Murray, and he passed away a few years ago, and I inherited, or I should say the place that I work, the Poynter Institute, inherited more than 100 of his daybooks, and it was fascinating to read through those. And all writers need a kind of seed bed where you begin to kind of grow ideas. You begin to collect words that are going to turn into something bigger. And I think a lot of people mistakenly believe that Twitter, for example, is a simple distillation of some longer thing you may have written. But for me, it often works the opposite way, that I'll write two or three Twitter feeds on a particular topic, and suddenly something begins to grow. Something grows something much larger. It could be a chapter, an essay, a chapter, or an entire book. And so my my daybook is kind of another way of collecting wonderful fragments, interesting words and phrases, ideas that I'm going to sort of pick up at another time. Another important place that I collect language is in the margins of the books that I'm reading. Marginalia, historically, is one of the most significant forms of short writing. It's a way where you get to speak, but talk back to the author of the book, a way where you can kind of formulate your own ideas and to explore the interesting ways that meaning is made.
Where are some of the places we can find some good examples of short writing?
Well, historically, they're in many, many different places. I made a little list of both new and old forms of short writing. So I've got, let's say, if I may just read a little passage from the book, it says, here, for example, is a list, not exhaustive, of the forms of short writing that users of the Internet have inherited in one way or another. Prayers, epigrams, wisdom literature, epitaphs, short poetic forms such as haiku, language on monuments, letters, rules of thumb, labels as on poison bottles, lyrics, ship logs, diaries, journal entries, bumper stickers, graffiti, advertisement, news dispatch, pieces of dialogue or conversation, weddings and other announcements, headlines, captions, summaries, telegrams, notes, microfiction, insults, headlines, tattoos. And so it's all around us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the messages and fortune cookies. It's on the back of baseball cards.
Lots of everywhere. Places to look. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And the book is called How to Write Short.
That's right. That's Roy Peter Clark. I'm Cynthia Schuster with Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.